Good morning, I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. My home group, to tell it like it is, group in Palm Beach Gardens, and my sobriety date's January the 5th of 1990. I am a Yankees fan, for sure. I know. And a long-suffering Jets fan, for sure. That's a curse that is sometimes almost feels as bad as being of alcoholism, you know, as being a Jet fan. But let me just get right to the point. I am really, really glad to be here. If you're new, I just want to let you know that if you hate Alcoholics Anonymous, you might hate it as much as I once did, but I assure you, not more than I once did. And I will get into that. I am not one of those people who has the story who says that I came to my first AA meeting and I felt right at home. Like, that's not my story. I felt horrified in Alcoholics Anonymous the first time I came here. I was 14 years old. I was surrounded by all the church-going freaks that were friends with my parents. Everybody was the age of at least my parent or my hall monitor or my guidance counselor or my principal or older. And actually the first meeting I came into looked a lot like this with the long tables. But it was a smoker's paradise. It's the first place somebody my parents' age encouraged me to smoke was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't get sober. I was in and out for 9 years until I was 23. But, you know, I'll let you know, if you are new, there's a line in one of our books that says, "Won't all kinds of odd people show up?" Well, I just want to let you know, that's not a question anymore. Millions of odd people have shown up. Like, we're all here. Millions of odd people have shown up. And if you're new, I just want to assure you that even if you don't like being here, like, you're in for the ride of your life. Like, miracles happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some are, I don't know, super spiritual. Some are hilarious. Certain things happen here to people like us that don't happen anywhere else in the world, that the rest of the human planet can't understand. I could give you my first one. I wasn't even permanently sober yet. I was still in and out in my 9 years of counting days. You know, in New York, we count days. And there used to be this guy that I hated because, you know, just to fill you in on when you get sober in New York, I'm Billy, I have 19 days. I'm Billy, I have 18 days. I'm Billy, I have 20 days, whatever. But then you learn the lingo. So now I'm Billy with 32 days back. You got to add the back, right? You want to make sure that everyone knows this is my first rodeo. I got 32 days back, and there was this guy I hated, and he sat in the back of the room, and he would always scream out, "Back from where?" You know? Every time I said, "I'm Billy, I got 18 days back," he would scream out, "Back from where?" And but what also happened when I was a teenager is that now this seems, if I was in work in my conference room with all the people I work with and tried to explain this, they wouldn't be able to understand it. But here, it's not a big deal. But in the rest of the world, they would think impossible. But here's the true story. When I was in 11th grade, I was probably 16, maybe 17, probably 16. The lady who took me out of the gym locker room to the principal's office for smoking, who got me 5 extra days of detention, the next Friday night gave me a Marlboro Red at an AA meeting. Like, that is impossible in the regular world, right? Like, the bond that exists among us that suffer is one that we will do anything. for another sufferer. So a couple of things that I just want to mention. I want to thank my girlfriend for coming. I want to thank any friends that are here. This is to celebrate a group. I'll tell you about myself, but I would much rather talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll tell you about myself. But I will start off talking about the importance of a group. And that's what we're here to celebrate today. And in our world today, home groups have almost gone out of fashion. You know, I came into AA in 1980. Today, we have lots and lots of meetings, but if you ask somebody what's their home group, sometimes people wouldn't be able to tell you. Or they'll tell you they have two or three. The group is the most single important unit in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is nothing more important than the home group. There is nothing more important than the parking lot of the home group. Like, I've been to this meeting before, and I don't need a video camera to tell me about the history of that parking lot. Like, I know that obviously this is a great meeting. A lot of miracles have probably occurred in this room, but not as many as in that parking lot. Like, the parking lots of Alcoholics Anonymous are the miracle creation point for alcoholics. Like, I know that somebody has walked outside of this building not having a good day, not having a good week, maybe not having a good month. That person might have had 2 days or 20 years. They might have said nothing in the meeting, but someone noticed something was off. Someone made it 10 feet out that door before somebody else said, "Hey," or "How you doing?" or called out their name. Like, I know we've become, you know, infatuated with stay-at-home AA. And I'm not here to say I'm against, you know, this overall good purpose that, you know, online groups can have, because there are some good purposes. But the main thing missing is that parking lot. The main thing missing is the physical connection of how many lives have been saved in those parking lots. And, you know, I just want to share something with you. If you don't know this story, it was in the grapevine a long time ago, but I know it pretty intimately. Is that, you know, in almost, you know, we just had the anniversary of a horrible event that passed. But, you know, in 1983, there was a young AA member from North Carolina, and he got orders to go to a place called Beirut, Lebanon. At the time, much like now, that was not a good place to get orders to go to. That young member of Alcoholics Anonymous got sent to the Beirut airport, which was, you know, a very dangerous place to be. And as talked about in some grapevine letters, you know, he wrote the office in New York and said that he was young and new, and that he was on a combat mission, and that he had no AA literature with him, and he was having a rough time, a really rough time. And so the lady who answered the mail in at the New York General Service Office mailed this young Marine a letter and a big book and a couple of pamphlets, and of course put in, you know, the classic line that we always put in, which is, you know, "If you're ever in New York, please stop by." And, you know, he wrote back, you know, a month later, like any good alcoholic, and said, "Thank you, but please send me more literature." And then they sent more literature. And then a month later, he wrote back again, except this time he used some of Bill W.'s language. He wrote back and said, "I have good news to report. I've started a group here. It's called the Peacekeepers Group. We have some Marines and other service people, and we have some local people. And in between the shelling and everything else going on, we have meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But now I really need a lot more literature because I got a group, you know? And so the lady in GSO wrote him back and sent him a package of literature through the military mail. And he wrote back and said, thank you. And they went on until the lady at GSO didn't hear from him for a couple of months. And then she got a letter from somebody else in the Peacekeepers group of Alcoholics Anonymous in December of 1983. And that letter was from another member, and that member said, she said, that she had the heartbreaking job of letting the woman he was corresponding with at GSO know that that young member was killed in the barracks blast of October of 1983, where almost 300 U.S. service people were killed. But she wanted the woman at GSO to know that the group was still alive, that the group was still going on. Now, you can Google AA in Lebanon today, and you can see that if you happen to go there, what nights of the week you could go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because a young Marine who died a hero, but I'm not sure his family knows the extent of it, because a young Marine needed literature, because people like you put money in a basket. Sometimes we get all tied up in AA meetings talking about politics as far as money and, oh, that service is politics, the district is politics, the intergroup is politics. That's just ridiculousness. That money in the basket is miracle creation money. It is not politic money. You know, because there was money for some lady to send one stupid letter that took her 3 minutes with a big book, there's now Alcoholics Anonymous in the country. And if you don't know this fact, I'll share it with you. Over 70% of the countries in the world today that have Alcoholics Anonymous, you can trace member number one back to a man or a woman who served in the United States or Canadian military. That they were there, they started one group. They started one group, and today that country has Alcoholics Anonymous, which is just simply amazing. I have a friend, Noli, who serves in the Irish Defense Forces, and he spends a lot of time in Lebanon at in a UN peacekeeping force. And I was washing my motorcycle not too many years ago, and I got a phone call through Facebook, which at that time I didn't even know was possible. But I answered it, and it was Noli. And he said, Billy, I just went to Jay's group. I'm in Beirut. I mean, AA is filled with miracle stories like that. Filled. And the importance of a group, I can't emphasize enough. Now, in my own personal life, in my belief in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's important to know that I showed up here an atheist, and not the kind of run-of-the-mill Alcoholics Anonymous atheist. Where I come from, the era that I am, which I hate getting older and hate dating myself, but I came into AA when it was like all of a sudden people like Inner Child stuff appeared, and ESP appeared, and Landmark appeared, and all these other self-help gurus, they all appeared. And also it became very popular to say you were a recovering Catholic, which today I know is disrespectful to anyone who might be Catholic sitting in the audience. I don't have a right to call out anybody's religion just for the sake that I mean... The same way I have no right to call out somebody for not believing, I have no right to call out somebody for believing. I absolutely do not. So I'm not the run-of-the-mill atheist who is that. I just don't like that my mother, you know, because truthfully, I never went to church. You know, I got a bulletin and stuck it in my back pocket. And I went back in the woods where all the bad kids with bulletins in the back of their pocket go, whose parents sent them to church. I mean, so nobody did anything to me. I don't or did not believe in God. It's almost embarrassing for me to admit this today because I thought only stupid people believed in God. I thought people that were just less blessed with less intelligence believed in God. That they needed some magic man in the sky who they could blame all their pathetic lives on, and if something didn't go their way, it's because the magic man in the sky. Like, this was, it doesn't make me sound good, but I'm just want you to know the truth of the extent of my atheism when I came here. And I bring up this story because it's an important part of my progression in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially because I was introduced by someone who's obviously been raised his whole life to blame 100 years of bad baseball with a curse, right? So, there's no curse, by the way. There was never a curse. It was just bad baseball, but you know that I am a diehard New Yorker, which that makes me come from the one of two camps, the New Yorkers and the Akronites in Ohio. You know, if you've been to Founders Day or been to Akron and you go there, they say, welcome home. They want to claim that they invented AA. I, however, know a New Yorker went there and brought it there, thank God. But the truth is, and I want to share this with you, is that it's really Massachusetts that is the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say that with 100% conviction. 100% conviction. That it's easy to go to a conference or a convention and you hear all kinds of nonsense. What sounds good? You can buy all kinds of nonsense. You can buy a shirt or a calendar, and one of the popular ones will say, it'll say, Dr. Young told Roland, Roland told Evie, Evie told Bill, Bill told Bob. But that's like the worst history lesson in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I'm convinced probably is, you know, reinvented all the time to take us away from really what our roots are. And as much as I wanted to deny that, I have to accept who we are and where we came from. You know, and long before 1935, you know, in 1909, there is a university in Worcester, Massachusetts called Clark. And Clark was celebrating its 20th anniversary. And as a result of that, they wanted to invite some of the smartest people in the world there. And they wanted the smartest psychiatrist living in the world. And at that time, it was Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud accepted that invitation, which has nothing to do with AA. But Sigmund Freud had gotten rid of his assistant about 3 years before that, and he hired a new doctor, assistant, protege, intern, resident, call him what you want. That man's name was Carl Jung. Carl Jung came to America in 1909 and went to Clark to carry Dr. Freud's bags, to keep track of his schedule, to like do all the grunt work. And while he was there, I mean, you can Google what I'm saying, some of Freud's most important talks to the rest of the world, not the AA world, happened there. It has nothing to do with all of us, but the rest of the world thinks, have documented. Something else happened there is the reason we're all here today, is that Dr. Jung ran into the psychologist named William James, who wrote the Varieties of Religious Experience that is talked about in the Big Book, and spent a lot of time with William James. And William James was not a Freudian believer. Varieties of Religious Experience is a difficult book to read, but I could tell you the sections that are really good to read. But he got through to Dr. Jung and said that for thousands of years since man started, people have been having what he called sudden transformational spiritual experiences. that revolutionized their lives. Entire psychic changes. Pirates. Slave ship captains. Like the slave ship captain who wrote the words to Amazing Grace and became a preacher. Like people since the beginning of time had had these revolutionary psychic changes. But William James warned Dr. Young that the problem with them was they were as rare as getting struck by lightning. That they didn't happen a lot. So really, that shirt or magnet or calendar that you buy in some drunk junk store should say, William told Carl. Carl told Roland. Roland told Ebby. Ebby told Bill, and Bill told Bob. Because between 1935 and 1939, when that book was published in April of 1939, I mean, that's why they published that book. They realized that they had the recipe to get struck by lightning if you were an alcoholic. Like, that's what our book is. It's exactly what William James talked about. Like, we found a way, regardless of what God you believe in or don't believe in, we found a way to have a transformational spiritual experience. That's what happened in April 39 when that book came out. Now, when I came here at 14 years old, I didn't know that. I just thought you wanted to take my party away. I thought you wanted me to live a boring, glum life. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about where I come from. My parents are both Depression-era Irish Catholics. That doesn't make me alcoholic. All four of my grandparents came off the boat through Ellis Island. My parents did the pilgrimage. You know, in my family, I have 42 first cousins. Basically, all starts from Queens and Brooklyn. And then depending on the firehouse or the police precinct you're assigned to, you move to Nassau County, Suffolk County, Staten Island, up into, you know, before the laws changed, when you couldn't live in New Jersey if you were a cop or fireman in New York, they would move up to Clarkstown and Newtown up in Rockland County. All dependent upon where the dad and that family worked. My parents moved out to Suffolk County. Where I grew up in Suffolk County is just a duplication of where my parents moved from Brooklyn. Like, it was the same neighborhood. If you went down my street, I mean, I could still tell you from the top of my block to the bottom of my block in Suffolk County, the family that lived there, and what the dad did. I could tell you if he was a transit cop, a housing cop, FDNY, drove a train for the subway, drove a train for the Long Island Railroad, was in Local 3, was in Local 1. Like, there were just certain jobs in certain places that we come from. You know, even my crazy mom, when right before she got diagnosed with cancer, God bless her. But I remember one day I called her from my office in Chicago. And she said, Billy, I'm selling the house. And I was like, just thinking to myself, thank God. Like, my one aunt had moved to the Villages already. My other aunt moved to the Villages. My other aunt moved to North Carolina. My mom was holding on to this house that they bought in 1967 that was never supposed to be as worth as much money as it is today. And my mother is still there. I said, that's great, Mom. Where are you going? She goes, I'm moving back to Brooklyn. I was like, what? Like, what are you talking about, Mom? She said, oh, yeah. I just want to sit outside on the stoop at night and smoke. I said, Mom, they don't do that anymore in the neighborhood you grew up in. Like, there's lots of other things that happen outside those doors, but the, like, neighbors don't gather anymore on their lawn chairs and save spots in the street and smoke cigarettes and... She's like, no, that's what I'm going to do. But my parents did the best they could with what they had. My mom went to Catherine Gibbs. I'm sure some of you remember that. She went to become a secretary. She was a secretary on Wall Street for one of the big oil companies. My dad was a police officer. They met on the Jersey Shore. It's already a recipe for disaster. My dad, you know, behavior on the Jersey Shore in today's world, he would have never lasted past probation as a police officer. Ever. Between cameras and social media and everything. But they moved out to do what they thought they were supposed to do. Give their kids a better life. Raise them on Long Island. Be away from the city. My dad was a deep cover narcotics agent. Alcoholic. Violent. If you lived in the house, you couldn't stand him. People outside the house thought he was the greatest guy in the world. I'm sure I'm not the only one that comes from a house like that. I'm not blaming my dad for me being an alcoholic. I'm just giving you the lay of the land so that I am not, you know, sugarcoating where I come from. My mom, basically an untreated Al-Anon, untreated codependent her entire life until circumstances later on led her to have to seek some help. We were raised with certain rules in my house. We don't lie, we don't steal, we don't cheat, but we lie when it comes to covering up for drinking. That's okay. Like, if we're going to your cousin's first communion on a Sunday, and your dad fell coming in the door on Saturday night, we don't talk about that. You know, like, every week, when you have 42 Irish Catholic first cousins, it means that every weekend of first communions, confirmations, graduations, it's every single weekend. And for us, what that meant is that when we got in that Ford Country Squire station wagon, that whatever happened that week, you're under orders to forget about immediately. Like when those doors open up at Grandma's in Bay Ridge or Aunt Joe's in Staten Island, like when you get out of that car, yeah, nobody else gets to know what happens in our house. Like, you need to learn that from a young, young age. Like, the only people privy to the secrets of the house are the people who live in the house, period. Like, I learned that lesson before I started drinking. Like, I mentioned something one day on the bus stop that I witnessed or heard in the middle of the night. That kid told his mother. His mother ran into my mother at King Cullen. My mother then told my dad that night, you won't believe what Billy told the kid next door. And then my dad beat the hell out of me. And I'm not an alcoholic because he beat the hell out of me. I just want to be very clear about where I come from. I do not come from a family that mixes well with others, by the way. Just want to be honest about that. I basically showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous pretty anti-Semitic, pretty racist, pretty homophobic. Like, the rule in my house, there's one thing that goes against all other rules. If you have a shield in your pocket. If you have a shield, which the language back then was a tin, if you have a tin in your pocket from whatever job you're on, well, then you're allowed in our backyard and you can come to our parties. Like, that's just where I come from. Like, there was a fireman killed in the town I come from when I was growing up. My dad decided to have a St. Patrick's Day parade in the middle of the night after the funeral because the bagpipe band and everybody else was in our backyard. Like, it didn't matter what color you were or whether you were male or female or anything like that when I was growing up, if you belonged to that other fraternity of law enforcement. But other than that, we judge everybody. Everybody. I also didn't know that alcohol was bad because my family doesn't believe in alcoholism. So I want you to know that. It's hard to recover from something that the people who supposedly love you the most tell you doesn't exist or is fake or not real. I try to explain it like this. when my mother died of cancer, she was diagnosed in 99 and she died in 2000. But while she was sick, a couple of times I had, you know, the opportunity. I was 9 years, 10 years sober to take her to chemo and radiation a few times. It was the one time, like, where the bad son was useful to her, you know? Because the rest of my siblings were very good. And so, like, I would buy her a fresh pack of Kent 100s. I didn't care. Like, Mom, I know, you're dying, and you want a cigarette? I would want one, too. Smoke up. My other siblings, that's way too over the line of bad behavior, right? But when I think about taking my mom to chemo, I just want to tell you that, how crazy would this sound? I mean, imagine if I stopped on Northern Boulevard, Jericho Turnpike, whatever, and pulled off into a parking lot, put the car in park, took my seatbelt off, looked at my mother, said, you know, Mom, get your head out of your ass. Can't you act like everyone else? Can't you be healthy like every other kid's mom? No, I tell you that because that's how my mother and father dealt with my alcoholism. I can't tell you how many times as a kid we would be driving somewhere. Like, I hated to be alone in the car with my dad because I knew what was coming. Like, there was going to be a stop that I knew he was going to make that we weren't supposed to make. He was going to put the car in park. He never wore a seatbelt. And even my mother would put the car in park and they would look at me and say, Billy, why can't you be like all the other kids? Why can't you have a little fun on the weekend and do the right thing during the week? Like, why do you always have to take it to the next level? Why do you always have to go so far? Like, why can't you just be like everybody else? Because they didn't believe in alcoholism. My Aunt Jo is the first person I know in my family who got sober. All I know is my dad called her Crazy Aunt Jo. That's it. That's it. She lived in Great Kills, Staten Island. It's the first bar I remember drinking in as a teenager was a place called the Swiss Chalet. And my aunt had a big book in every bedroom. I remember when I finally did get sober, like, war fever ran high. Like, where do I know that from? And then it finally hit me on the head when I was like 4 years sober. Crazy Aunt Jo's house. But Aunt Jo got sober. Like, she found AA. And I remember my mom telling me one time that if you were an alcoholic, it meant you couldn't drink at all, which I didn't understand. Like, it made no sense to me. Like, if I showed you a family photo album, you would notice a theme. My mother's always pregnant. She always has a child in her arms and a Kent 100 in her hand. Like, and I'm not saying that was bad. I'm not judging her, right? Like, one of my prized possessions is my mother's sand ashtray from the dashboard. I don't know if you remember those. Used to have a lot of sand so they wouldn't move. You know, today if you smoked in a car with kids, you're like, you know, a capital killer. But back then it just went with the territory, right? I have that. And I have her Rubbermaid cigarette case with the little space for a pack of matches, you know? Like, and I have her bingo chips and her rosary beads, you know? But if you saw a picture of my dad, he would always be drinking. And every one of those parties I talked about going to, like, the only thing I can tell you is they all ended like a Cops episode. They all ended with my mom or one of my aunts holding a child that should have been in bed hours ago, screaming at my dad or one of my uncles. And, you know, I'm not judging. I'm just honest about where I come from. You know, in the house I grew up in, yeah, women don't talk back to men in public for certain. No doubt about it. And you definitely don't ever say that somebody had too much to drive home. Ever. You just don't say that in front of other people. Period. End of sentence. And, you know, so the reason I tell you that is because by the time I was 10, I knew what alcohol produced in my family. In my immediate family and in my extended family. It's just no one ever talked about the alcohol. Like, I grew up, I'm a product, you know, of the 70s. And, you know, construction workers weren't working. The union halls were full. Cops and firemen and EMS workers were getting laid off. We would have people in our family and friendship circles taking their own lives, and no one would ever say they were alcoholic. My mom would say something like, yeah, the electricians, they haven't worked for a year and a half. He couldn't deal with the pressure anymore. Or the one St. Patrick's Day, when after the St. Patrick's Day parade on Long Island, one police officer shot another one in the head at 4 o'clock in the morning in a car on the way home off the Long Island Expressway. No one would ever say that came from drinking. I just grew up in an environment that we drink. You know, I have some nieces and nephews today who I love very much, and if you saw their passports, you'd be like, wow. Like, I'm like, wow. Like, the furthest we went was Lake George, okay? That was a big family trip. Rockaway Beach, Lake George, whatever that park was called in... No, not Action Park. That was almost a little too bougie for us out there in New Jersey by the Playboy Club. No, the one up in Westchester, Rye Playground. Like, those were our vacations, you know. My nieces and nephews, who are like 10 and 12, have been everywhere on a plane. But my dad, he would sometimes pull up alongside one of the prisons upstate New York. And he would turn around to us and say, we drink, they drug. Get that through your head. My dad worked a lot of 4 to 12s. And when I was in elementary school, and before elementary school, my dad would take us down to the beach sometimes, the town park. And my dad would look at us, and there would be this row of like highway department trucks. And everybody's drinking and smoking weed inside those highway department trucks. And my dad would look at me and say, this is your future if you don't get your head out of your ass. Like, this is what's going to happen. At best, you're in a highway department truck smoking weed and drinking tall boys at lunchtime. Like, that's the best. Worst case is bad, but this is best. So I'm just telling you, I had a good upbringing, you know? But I also knew that alcohol was bad. I knew what it did to my dad's temper. I knew a lot of things. And I can't tell you what my first drink was. You know, and I can't tell you my whole drinking story, but I can tell you a couple of things that are important. One thing that's important to tell you, because I used to not talk about it, but I saw a movie like 10 years ago that really kicked my ass and made me start thinking about it, was... So I grew up in the pre-MTV days, right? The pre-Atari days. Atari came out like when I was in ninth grade or eighth grade. Like, if you were going to lose yourself in the house I grew up in, reading was the only alternative. Like, or listening to music, right? But all the music that I listened to, my mother called devil music, so I wasn't allowed to listen to it, right? Kiss Alive, banned. Ozzy, banned, you know? But I lost myself in reading. I would read anything I could get my hands on, including the encyclopedia. In the neighborhood I grew up in, there was like two dads in every neighborhood. One dad was the birthright dad, collected all the cribs. One dad sold encyclopedias part-time. And depending on how much money your family had, you had like a one book per letter encyclopedia or some letters combined. And my mother read Reader's Digest, you know, the small one with all the abridged stories. So I would read anything. So I knew by the time I was in sixth grade that I read everything I remembered everything I read. Like, I knew that. not to the point I knew today how much, because I don't have that ability as good as I used to. But I knew that I remembered what I read. And I knew that math came easy. Like easy, like I can do it in my head. And if it's very complicated, I can do it on a small napkin. Like I knew that. And I don't say that to brag, because I can tell you right now, any positive revelation I've ever had about myself, I have used for destructive purposes. I have used for no good, okay? But I can tell you, I always have to give disclaimers about people in the audience, and the two that I most pick on, I just want to say ahead of time so you don't leave, because I'll think I'm going to come back and tie it all up, and then I go on a tangent, and you leave resentful. So, if you're a social worker, I have the greatest respect in the world for what you do. I'm actually very involved with one of the largest homeless organizations in the country. If you're a social worker, you are on the battleground every day with whoever clients you're helping. But you're looking at a 57-year-old man that's never been invited to a meeting with a social worker where I got good news, right? Like, if there's a social worker in the meeting, somebody is about to tell me something I am not going to like listening to. So that's group number one. Group number two, I know I don't think I heard it announced during the countdown, but if there are any members here of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen, I just want to thank you and tell you that I have the greatest respect and admiration for you. But I'm a chronic teenage alcoholic. That means I don't have the story that there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and a head full of AA. That's not my story. My story is there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and my mother's head full of Al-Anon. That is my story. That is a much, much worse combination that I'll talk about a little bit. But I got caught cheating on a test when I was in sixth grade. And my mother had to come to school. And there was a guidance counselor. And my principal, not a guidance counselor, a social worker. My principal, my teacher, and my mother. Nothing written on my wrist or my hands. No piece of paper in my pocket. No cheat sheet. No nothing. The teacher just told my mother that based on your son's behavior walking to school and in the classroom and in the lunchroom and on the play field and walking home, there's no way he did that well on that test. That was her rationale. Take it a year later, I'm off to junior high, and I get put in all these special classes. Honors English, accelerated math, enriched social studies, all these, I guess they use the word gifted. When I showed up to accelerated math, I was not dressed like I am today. I had black engineer boots on, Levi dungarees or corduroys, some kind of heavy metal t-shirt. In the winter, I had an olive drab army jacket with the Who Quadrophenia symbol painted on the back of it. And in the fall and the spring, I had a Levi dungaree jacket with an Aussie oil painting on the back of it. That's how I went to school. This, you know, going to accelerated math is like going to your first big book study. It's all the people you would never hang out with, ever. You go to accelerated math, it's like when I went to my first Joe and Charlie big book study. Everybody is prepared. Everybody has the right notebook they were supposed to have. Everybody has like three different color highlighters and an eraser, and like those are the people. I did not last long in those classes. But you see, I had drank before that, what I consider drinking. Like in the book, in Bill's story, that I denied would ever identify with. This New Englander, another New Englander, by the way, who went to a prep school, who went to college, who was a veteran, an officer in the Army. Like there's a section of his story that says, I had arrived. Now, if you work through the big book with a man who's been through the big book, you'll be able to find when you arrived. It's there. I have two that are super important to me. I could tell you lots of great drinking stories. Lots. One about not too far from here. My dad. He would sit me down or call me. First time I went to spring break. Fort Lauderdale. He's like, Billy, those cops down in Florida are not like the cops you run into in New York. He's like, there's all kind of hillbilly cops all over the country. They're not going to care. Well, you know what? He was right. Because I got arrested for fighting, and they didn't care that my dad was an undercover narcotics agent. They did not care. Same thing when I went to Jamaica. Another disastrous trip. He's like, Billy, you know in Asia they locked up Sir Paul McCartney. Like, they didn't care who he was. Like, if you do something dumb in Jamaica, they are going to lock you up. Well, he was right. He was like Nostradamus. I did something dumb, and I got locked up. But that I had arrived, like, I found my arrival. Like, I always say to people, like, there's two things that make us alcoholic, our allergy and our obsession. That's it. That's what makes me an alcoholic. Like, I can't write a book about sobriety because I give the people who write books too hard a time. I can't make t-shirts because I give all the people who sell stuff too hard a time. Because I was raised that this is for fun and for free. Like, you don't make money off of God's children that are suffering. Period. That's the way I was raised in AA. But if I was going to have a shirt, because in AA you hear all those cliches, once a pickle, never a cucumber. Well, here's my story. Never a cucumber. Never. I don't know what it's like to be a cucumber. I've never been one. I've been a pickle from word go. Okay? I have had that allergy from word go. Now, I have a couple of other things that are wrong with me that don't make me alcoholic, but it seems other men that I run into AA, they have some of these problems too. If you tell me not to go somewhere, I'm going to go there. If you tell me not to do something, I'm going to do it. How about this? If you tell me to do something without giving me a legitimate reason why I need to do it, I'm never going to do it. And if you tell me not to hang out with somebody, male or female, I'm going to hang out with them. And one day, when I was in sixth grade, the end of sixth grade, going into the summer, see, there were these woods around the corner from my house. And my mom, when we went to the roller rink or the ice rink or the movie theater or the, what the hell was it? I forget what it was even called, that grocery store, but we would go there and my mom would point out the bad kids. The kids behind the movie theater, the kids hanging out on the side of the roller rink. She would say, yeah, do not hang out with those kids. And finally, one of those kids asked me to come to the woods. He said, Billy, we're all hanging out in the woods on Friday night. You should come with us, an older kid. I couldn't wait. And, you know, I tell people, like, you know, you ever read, you know, in high school yearbooks, you know, they have those things, you know, most successful, going to be most successful, whatever else. Like, a lot of people have lofty dreams. My dreams changed that night. Four things particularly changed my life. I'd never been to a bonfire in the woods. There was loud, at that time, every group of kids had a kid with a boom box with double cassettes and eight speakers, and there was heavy metal in the woods. There were girls in the woods, and there was alcohol in the woods. Particularly at that time, an 8-pack or 2 8-packs of the small Miller 8-ounce pony bottles. Like, I'm just being honest. Like, the day after that night, if the best my life got was a bonfire, loud heavy metal music, girls, and alcohol, I didn't need any more. Like, my life would be fine. Now, my other arrival was when I was like 19 years old, 7 years later, in an Irish bar. You know, it's funny when I run into other kids that got sober young. You know, I've never been able to celebrate my 21st birthday in a bar ever because I had been drinking there so long already. Like, somebody wants to buy me shots, and the bartender's like, what's birthday is it? I got to say it's 23 because I've already been there 2 years, you know? Can't say it's 21, but one night in an Irish bar at 19 years old, you know, if you're from New York, you know that bars close at 4 in the morning. And 3:30, quarter to 4 is last call. And I'm a bar drinker. I love everything about bar drinking. I love that my dad raised me as a bar drinker. It doesn't mean he had me drinking at the bar, but it means that I knew how to play every game of pool. I knew what points on a game was. I knew what a box was in a Super Bowl pool. I knew how to play every game of darts. I knew how to play 8-ball, 9-ball. I know everything about bars. I know that a man puts his money on the bar, doesn't need to put the change back in his pocket. The bartender will make change and leave it there for the next drink. I know that an upside-down shot glass means you have a drink coming. I knew all that by the age of 12. By 19 years old, I was a dedicated bar drinker. And this bartender came up to me that night at like 3:30 and said, Billy, you know, before we flash lights, last call, go back by the kitchen. Just stay there. And then last call happened and most people had to leave, except for about 8 or 10 people. And that night, even though it might sound crazy to the average human being, if I told people at work this, they would not know what to do with the information. But I became part of what I thought was a special class of society. I got to stay in the bar after it closed for an hour or two with the bartenders while they cleaned up and keep drinking. Like, I didn't need to go to 7-Eleven yet and get a case of beers and go to Sunken Meadow Park and drink on the lifeguard station. You know, I didn't need to get a case of beers and go down to the Kings Park Bluff and drink there. Like I get to stay with these special people now. And it sounds hilarious and pathetic, but that's just the truth of my life. You know, my life was intervened, and I'm dedicated to AA service, and I don't do as much as I used to. And I know that everybody in AA is a gift, but, you know, I wouldn't have called the juvenile court judge on Long Island an angel back in the day. I wouldn't have called that stupid DWI trailer next to the 4th Precinct in Hop Hog like a gathering of angels, you know? But today I know, you know, like, somebody intersected in my life that I will never know who it was. Probably today they're deceased. See, because the thing about institutional service as opposed to working with a newcomer is working with a newcomer is awesome because when you meet them on day zero and you're at their 1 year anniversary, it's like somebody just beamed somebody else different through Star Trek and like one person came out and another person showed up. But see, institutional service, when you're answering phones at Intergroup, or you're bringing meetings into a treatment facility, or you're going into a correctional facility. See, you don't know. It's like a snowball. You don't know. You don't see the end of that snowball. See, because when your dad is a violent undercover cop, you can play that card a lot if you're in trouble in school. Just tell the guidance counselor, you know, my house is a disaster. You know, my dad's in Florida and everywhere else and buying lots of kilos and always in trouble. And some days he comes home driving a New York telephone truck. And some days he comes home driving a Corvette. Some days he comes home driving a cab. Some days he comes home driving a tow truck. Like, you know, he's violent. He drinks. And you get people to feel sorry for you. But you see, I went to juvenile court because I had a PINS petition filed against me. A person in need of supervision. And this judge, he gave me a choice. And I want to be very clear about this. I had not been institutionalized yet anywhere the day I was in that juvenile court. But I was given a choice. Billy, you can live by this contract I'm going to make between you and your mother, and you can comply with it, or you're going to live in a juvenile correctional facility, detention facility, where we won't have to worry about if you go to school every day, and we won't have to worry about if you go to class when you go to school, because it'll be right there, behind a wall, behind a fence, and you can do that. Now, I wasn't scared to go to that facility. What I was scared of is I wouldn't be able to drink. See, by the time I was 14 years old, I know we throw the word progression a lot, but I'm going to explain my progression to you. By the time I was in ninth grade, the only thing I thought about on a Monday morning is where are we drinking on Friday night? Who has fake ID? Whose parents are away? By the time I was in 10th grade, the only thing that went through my mind is I can't make it to Friday night. Like everybody else can make it. It's no big deal. I can't make it. And by the time I was a senior, I never went to school on a Monday on time. So I choose this contract. It was a typical 1970s, 80s era. Billy will take the garbage out on Tuesdays and Thursday nights. Billy will be home during the week when the lights go on outside. Billy will come home on time on the weekends when his mother tells him. Billy will not smoke in the house. Billy will not smoke in school. And then the death nail. Billy will go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or William will go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, my dad hated AA. But I had no choice. This judge, he didn't care. This judge, he didn't feel sorry for me. He didn't give me anybody to blame things on. He just said, this or that. And that's why when I mention AA service, I don't know who whispered in that judge's ear. I don't know if he had a family member in AA. I don't know if he had a committee that said, hey, if a teenager comes in here, they might be alcoholic. Send them to AA. I don't know who did that. But that judge did that. Now, I was in and out of AA for 9 years. If I was going to write a book again, it would be take the time, not the probation. I'm bad at probation. I'm sure I'm not alone in this room. When I drink, I can't be on probation. I cannot survive probation while I am drinking. Like, I was dating myself. There were not these fancy computers. Today, the cop comes up to my car. He's well aware of certain things I've done in my life. Well aware. Back then, it was a guy on the radio or the woman on the radio. The cop would take my license or my name and go back and call it in. And I always got arrested for something that I didn't do in the past, not even what I just did wrong. I didn't finish my community service. I didn't pay a fine. I didn't show up for a new court date. I became just a vicious circle of violations of probation. I went to my first anniversary meeting when I was 16 years old. At that time, I was going to meetings in Northport and Comac and Kings Park and Smithtown. And it was a church room like this with a kitchen in the back, except in a basement. I only went because I could, my mother had become an Al-Anon. The only way I could manipulate her was with AA. Like, she wanted me to go to AA. I wanted to smoke my brains out, so I wanted to go to AA. And I had heard people in AA talking, can't wait to the last Friday night of the month, big anniversary meeting. So I told my mother that Friday afternoon, because I was grounded again. You know, Mom, they're having a big anniversary party tonight in AA. I'd really like to go to it. She's like, I'll drive you. Okay. I went to the anniversary party or meeting. An old woman turned the lights down halfway. She was like 34. An old guy came out of that kitchen like 40 years old with a cake with candles on it. And all these people started singing happy anniversary. I felt like I was listening to church music. Like, oh my God, like what is going on here? And, you know, I counted like 26, 36, 46, 56, like even if I live to 46, like this is my life now. The last Friday night of the month, the old lady who turns the lights down halfway and the guy with the cake and the candles and all these people singing, like I have a lot more planned. Little did I know, you know, COVID, I'm sure we all had our own moments where when it was really locked down and we were going crazy. You know, I identify with certain people in AA. I don't tell people how to stay sober. It's not my job. There's lots of ways to stay sober. It's my job if you ask me for help. Then you've invited me in. But, you know, I tend to identify with people who have lost everything. People who know what the human foot looks like when you haven't changed your socks in 30 days. People who have been locked up behind bars like animals. People who appreciate the old sand ashtrays. If you remember them, rich hotels and stuff, they would have a sand ashtray that they actually put their, like, symbol in. Somebody had a job, like, that's a good place, like, only certain people in society know that it's easier to relight a cigarette that somebody else smoked out of sand than someone who stepped on it on the subway platform. But if you want to smoke, yeah, then I'll take three out of the sand ashtray any day of the week. During COVID one time, I still had my place in Delray Beach. I remember I went out to Publix one day. And, you know, we all went kind of crazy, I guess, at a certain point. But I was walking down the aisle one time and I said, you know what? I'm going to have that for dinner for good old time's sake. Like, that's what I'm going to have for dinner tonight. I bought the good plastic 99-cent package of ramen noodles with the little seasoning package inside it, you know, that you dump into water. Like I know what it's like to live on ramen noodles for, like, months, you know? I know what it's like to... I'd rather smoke than buy food. Like, I know what it's like to have a meeting directory where I have meetings circled that have cookies and food and coffee because my life depends on it. You know, when I, you know, I'm just going to tell you a couple of things. I'm going to shut up. You know, I could not stay out of trouble. And I got into a bad accident and I was going to go inside and... I just want to, just from the bottom of my heart, thank the men and women who bring meetings into correctional facilities. You know, I was 5 months sober when I finally went in. If anybody remembers the Buster Douglas-Mike Tyson fight, I was counting days at the time, and some guy in AA invited me to his house, and they had it on pay-per-view, and they were playing cards and eating pizza, and... I saw guys laughing and having a good time together. And a couple of months later, you know, I had to go inside. And I had gotten moved from this one maximum facility to a minimum facility. And I was struggling, to be honest. I'm very honest about that. That, like, whatever my psychiatric profile it is, it doesn't do well in minimum security correctional facilities. I'm better in a cell with one or two others, with a day room for like 10 cells in front of us where I can watch TV and eat and not have to engage with a lot of people. My temperament and my temper was not made for that kind of living. So when you put me in a room like this with 100 bunk beds and I have to tie my shoes or my sneakers to my cot so that I can hear if you're stealing them in the middle of the night, like, I'm not going to survive well in there, which I did was not doing well, for sure. I was running into trouble already. But the one thing they had was really good AA. They had really good kick-ass AA. And, you know, sometimes people talk about, you know, there's nothing worse than bringing a speaker into a correctional facility who you've heard speak a million times, and then you bring them into a correctional facility, and all of a sudden they're cursing more. Or they're making their story sound super violent or super crazy. First of all, in South Florida, I mean, nothing against anyone, but Every young guy I meet is a crime lord from somewhere else. Like, I've had this discussion outside Crossroads and Oasis a bunch of times. Like I get how big your criminal enterprise is, but you wouldn't be in South Florida talking to me right now if it was that big. Like, you would have went north of the five boroughs instead of south. But, you know, inside, we need good members of Alcoholics Anonymous who have just become good people, who just are recovered members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, my life was saved, I guess, by a tape. They were allowed to bring us in speaker tapes. And I had a Walkman. I'm dating myself again, right? At that time, like, the number one song was either You Can't Touch This or Hammer Time. And I'm a heavy metal freak, so... But I listened to a tape that I grabbed out of a cardboard box. It said, Tom I, Aberdeen, North Carolina. And I went back to my cot, and I listened to a tape of a man who killed two people drinking and driving when he was 23, who had become the first convicted felon in the history of the United States to become the warden of a maximum custody penitentiary. Like, you see, there's a spiritual principle that existed long before AA. And that's that the hopeless can only be saved by someone equally as hopeless. You know, it's kind of like we know things that other people don't know. You know, we hear all the jokes, a rabbi, a priest, you know, who knows, walks by the alcoholic in the hole. They all try to help him, and kind of the bad information story you hear is that the alcoholic walks by and looks down and says, oh, I'll jump in with you. That's really not the truth. The alcoholic walks by and gives the first piece of advice that we give everybody. Stop digging. Like, that's rule number one of getting out of a hole. You got to stop digging. You have to stop. You have to have a sobriety date. After a sobriety date, we can work with everything else. But that tape, I just want to share this. I went to Tom's funeral this year, about 8 months ago, 9 months ago, I guess. It was almost like being in the Matrix, in an alternative universe. Because there's his wife sitting up front. I know that he's a convicted felon. I know that he stayed for a good part of his 20s in Jackson Prison in Michigan. And yet, to my right, the governor sent the honor guard from the North Carolina Department of Corrections. And the honor guard from the North Carolina Department of Corrections is playing taps. And an officer from the North Carolina Department of Corrections kneels in front of Tom's wife and gives him a North Carolina Department of Corrections flag on behalf of the governor. Like, that doesn't... The people at work, they can't understand that. That doesn't make sense to them. Like, how is it possible that a convicted inmate became a warden and now is being honored? Like, that man's tape gave me hope. And, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's our job. Now, I met Joe and Charlie, and I met them many times. And I had to concede that I didn't know anything about anything. And I don't put them on a pedestal, just so we're clear. I don't care how you work the steps, as long as you do. It's not my business to tell you how to work them. But I knew that I had been saying, my name's Billy, I'm an alcoholic, since I've been 14 years old. And I didn't know what that meant. I just knew I was supposed to say it. I didn't know that it meant I was mentally and bodily and physically different from everybody else in the world. I didn't know that I had this allergy that once I start drinking, I can't stop. I didn't know that I had a mental obsession and that that's why we work the steps. We work the steps because one drink is a stick of dynamite to me. Now, I just want to say something, and this is my experience of working with many young men here and other places. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want everybody to get sober. That is a fact of my life. Everybody to get sober. But if you're not an alcoholic, I don't care what else you are. You could be a sex addict, a gambling addict, a codependent, an Al-Anon. I could go on and on. You could be a million other things as long as you're an alcoholic. But I'm going to tell you, I had the privilege to serve on the board of Alcoholics Anonymous up at GSO. And when I was done, I got to serve on the Heroin Anonymous board. And what led me there was my self-destructive behavior towards other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Me believing what the treatment world was telling people, that everybody is the same. Me believing what the treatment world is saying is that if you're a codependent, you're a food addict, you're a sex addict, you're a gambling addict, you're an alcoholic, you're a drug addict, it's not true. Some people are many of those things. But I learned for me that my ego was way out of whack when somebody would tell me they're not an alcoholic. And I would think that I, because I've been through steps 2 to 12, I could help them. Like, I got really active in Heroin Anonymous, and I'm a non-heroin addict. But I met hundreds of members of Heroin Anonymous who were dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my only message to people in AA is, don't believe that we're the only group gathered together on a Saturday morning who could be doing other things, boating, golfing, whatever. Other fellowships are not bad. Other fellowships, they have active people like we do. They're gathered together right now, being as active as we are. I've had to learn and check my ego with my stupid AA big book ego. I've had to keep meeting directories for other fellowships in my car. Because I don't try to convince anyone they're an alcoholic anymore. If I meet you and you tell me you're something else, then I'm going to take you to that meeting. No, I'm not going to kick you out of AA. I'm not going to stop you from coming to AA. But people are dying every day. I got tired of going into my clubhouse and seeing flyers on the wall for people who OD'd, who said they weren't alcoholic, but somebody was trying to force AA down their throat. Like, I can't be that arrogant anymore. Now, if you tell me you're alcoholic and a million other things, I welcome you in AA. I don't kick anybody at AA. I don't judge. But I also don't try to force AA on anybody. Like, I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. So I do want to thank the people who did service to put this on. And I do want to thank, because there has to be people in here who are answering phones, probably the most unglamorous but worthwhile job in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people on the other end of that phone, the people who can tell somebody I've been there, the people who can take somebody and get them to their first meeting. It's why I love the traditions and the service structure. It's not because I'm some AA geek. 2 weeks ago, I'll tell you my weekend. Remember that kid who was in that 16 years old, in that anniversary meeting, you're going to take my party away? Here's what I did 2 weeks ago. On Friday night, I saw Iron Maiden and Guns N' Roses. On Saturday night, I saw AC/DC and Judas Priest. On Sunday night, I saw Tool and Metallica with 80,000 other people. Like, AA has given me my life back. No doubt about it. I get to live life beyond my wildest dreams. However, AA was only here on January the 5th of 1990 because the people on January 4th of 1990 were taking care of it and cared about it more than they did themselves and cared about the traditions more than they did themselves and put principles in front of personalities to make sure the doors stay open, the meeting directories get printed, the phones are answered. Like, that's our job. You know, sometimes I get a little upset when the service structure gets all involved in guidelines and bylaws and all this other stuff, when our number one responsibility in life I don't know who else here has been to business school or graduate school, but if you've learned anything about marketing, there's a commercial from people my age that they use as an example. It was never supposed to be successful. It was a budget-made commercial. And yet it's one of the most successful TV commercials in the history of TV. And the tagline was, "Leave the light on," for a budget motel. And that's what our job is. Our job is to not only leave the light on, but God's given us one extra instruction. Don't do anything to turn the light off. Don't treat AA in such a way that the light burns out. Treat AA in such a way that the light is brighter, so that people dying of this disease can find it. Because there's a lot of people who die of alcoholism. We get tired of hearing that. It's a statistic we get bored of hearing, how many people die of alcoholism. The one that bothers me is how many alcoholics die of alcoholism who never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the one that drives me crazy, and that's the job of the service structure. So, it's funny. I traded messages last week with Harold L. He wanted to make sure I didn't forget to say he's a big friend of this group. He wanted me to say, make sure that this group hears his happy anniversary from St. Louis. I want to tell you thank you for having me here today, and thank you for being such a strong beacon of light.